This is General Sir Walter Walker, tape 4 of 4.
When I was eventually relieved by General Lee, despite the fact that the Tunku had asked for me to stay on, but my master said I must go out into the NATO world and enlarge my vision, cloud operations were in full swing. The Indonesian army was deployed against us. And during the time that General Lee was director of operations, instead of it being a platoon commander's battle, it was a company commander's battle. And he was fighting pitched battles with the Indonesian army, both sides using artillery and mortar support, but we were not using air support. And in fact, as Healy said to the House of Commons, not one bomb was dropped on our side of the border. And he the other day congratulated himself on the fact that he'd given that order, when in fact I gave it. So General Lee was fighting a conventional war against the Indonesian army.
So could you just talk about CLAD as success or failure? Did the policy work? Well, I mean, were there bad examples?
No, I can't think of. Well, certainly in my time, there was not one single failure of CLAD. There was nearly a hiccup when a battalion of Gurkhas was involved in the Claret operation, and they had 2 men wounded, and it was a Sunday. And my senior staff officer rang me up to say that the Royal Air Force refused to give permission for a helicopter to go across the border and pick up these men who were bleeding to death. And it was touch and go that the Gurkhas were able to get them out, A, because they were so wounded, and B, because the Indonesians were very close. And the only way to get them out, and the Gurkhas to get out, in fighting a rear guard action, would be to lift them out by helicopter. And as the Royal Air Force refused to do it, the commanding officer came on at my request, the blower to me, and gave me the exact situation. And I said, I authorize a helicopter, but my God, if you fail and let me down, you've got the chop.
Because you were breaking one of your own rules.
And furthermore, I hadn't even spoken to the commander in chief. I should have spoken to the commander in chief. And I said, how far are the Indonesians away from your wounded? He said, they're very close indeed. But if I can get a helicopter in the next 5 minutes, I can get them out, and I guarantee success. So I said, okay, let it go. And I rang up the commander-in-chief.
Sorry, it's not a good name. Yeah.
I rang up the commander-in-chief on the secret blower and said, I have had to authorize this without reference to you because the circumstances were so. He said, quite right.
This was our Navy man. This was
Admiral of Fleets of Albeg.
And so that was the one exception, perhaps, to the rule about the helicopters going over.
Well, I don't know whether General Lee had to make any exceptions, but that was the only exception I made.
Will you make one more point, sir, which is this question of minimum force? There's an irony, was that, in fact, you didn't actually want to. You had a limited objective in Claret.
Yes, the object of Claret was to knock the Indonesians off force so that they were unable to launch their cross-border attacks. But in order to do so, it was not necessary to wipe out a whole company and get involved in a pitched battle. And furthermore, one did not want Sukarno to advertise to the world that we were across the border. If we were able to inflict minimum damage on his forces without him losing face, then he was unlikely to scream about it. If, on the other hand, we were to do the opposite by wiping out a whole company, then, of course, he would screech.
It's a very delicate line.
Yes.
So, one more point. Now, the enemy in Indonesia, it seems to me... Sorry, so I'm going to ask...
Well, my assessment of confrontation, I think, is best summed up by Mr. Dennis Healey, when he was Secretary of State for Defense, and he paid this tribute to our forces in the House of Commons on November the 27th, 1967. And he said, when the House thinks of the tragedy that could have fallen on a whole corner of a continent, if we had not been able to hold the situation and bring it to a successful termination, it will appreciate that in the history books it will be recorded as one of the most efficient uses of military force in the history of the world. The experience that went into this operation is in danger of being lost, and that experience is concentrated at present in part of the British Army, only part, and that part are Gurkha troops, because the rest of the army is trying to convert itself into a peri-continental force at a time when it has unique political relations and military skills for handling worldwide threats of another kind. And in my opinion, this is a serious problem which ought to be faced. Yes. You see, the Gurkhas had no MP to represent them in Parliament. And I, therefore, as Major General Brigade of Gurkhas, regarded them as, or regarded myself, rather, as their MP. And it was up to me to fight their battles. And after all, we had a treaty with Nepal. And when it was decided that the Brigade of Gurkhas was to be cut in the middle of a campaign, let me remind you, in the middle of a campaign, I resisted. Particularly when I found out that the King of Nepal himself, with whom he had a treaty, had not been consulted. And that was going behind his back. And so I fought hard. And for fighting hard, I was hauled over the coals to such an extent that I was withdrawn from the middle of an important operation in Borneo and flown home and threatened with a court-martial. It wasn't until I'd retired and I was at a dinner party when the former Secretary of State for the Army, who is now a Lord, came across to me and said, I have never been able to apologize to you for what the Chief of the General Staff threatened you with without any reference to me as Minister for the Army. And we would never have allowed you to have been court-martialed. Please accept my apologies.
There is that also, that personal slight to the... I mean, it seems so petty, but as it reflected not only, you know, a withdrawal, I mean, not giving the commander of the director of operations, Borneo, the normal gong. I mean, this must have irked.
Well, it was very funny because Lord Mountbatten came to visit Borneo, and of course, quite unbeknown to me, being a soldier, I did not know that I had been put in for a knighthood. because you're not asked whether you'll accept it like you are as a civilian. And Lord Mountbatten came down the steps of the aeroplane, and I was on the right of the line, and Admiral Begg was next to him. And he said to me, "I am very sorry indeed about your K." And he saw that I was absolutely astonished. So he turned to Admiral Begg and he said, "Doesn't he know about the K?" And Admiral Begg said, "No, sir." I mean, he wouldn't know until he was told. And he, Lord Mountbatten, in front of, or certainly in the hearing of the rest of the line, said, "You were put in for a K, and it was turned down by the Chief of the General Staff because of your resistance to the proposed cuts in the Brigade of Gurkhas. And we then put you in for CMG, and that was turned down. And you are now going to get a DSO." And I said, "But a DSO, I have two already. And a DSO is for gallantry or certainly under fire." And so when the citation was written, it was written in such a way that it appeared that I was flying over the jungle and close to the Indonesian frontier and continually under fire. And so that is the story to rub the salt into the wound, not my wound particularly, because I didn't care a damn. George Lee, General Lee, who succeeded me, was awarded a K, and Walker was not. It didn't aggravate me at all, but it aggravated my soldiers and it aggravated my officers. And I got hundreds of letters saying that this is quite disgraceful. I suppose the technique of counterinsurgency has changed, and that Northern Ireland would be a prime example where the army is in support of the police. That is correct for internal security in a city, but totally wrong when fighting terrorists, which is a new form of warfare. And that is my criticism of the situation in Northern Ireland.
But perhaps in the field, that it should be opened up in the field, or how could, with your experience, how can...
Well, I think that the army should be in control. And I have given many talks on terrorism as a new form of warfare. And it is the form of warfare that the Russians are absolutely expert at. Revolutionary war by proxy. Get someone else to do your dirty work for you. Now, we know that the Russians would love to have a naval base at Cork or nuclear bases in Northern Ireland. We know that the IRA are trained by the Libyans and by others, and we know that the Libyans are trained by the Russians. And so it all comes back to Russian technique of subversion. And I think we take far too narrow a view of what is happening in Northern Ireland.
As a general, as a military man, how do you draw the line between treading on someone's civil liberties and actually effectively isolating the terrorist? How can one do it without?
How do you isolate the terrorists from the civilian population without treading on the toes of the civilians? I have talked to soldiers, and they know who the IRA are, and yet they can't pick them up. Is that the way to fight this new form of warfare, of terrorism? I would like to see the SES, for example, there in force. I think that the border should be absolutely buttoned up, and that the IRA would not be allowed to cross hither and thither at will, and that anyone suspected of an IRA being an IRA is immediately picked up. And the law must be changed. I mean, the civil law must not apply to this new form of warfare, terrorism. So I think our technique and our policy in Northern Ireland is totally, totally wrong.
It's certainly difficult to see how anyone can actually make any advance as it stands at the moment. Isn't it? It's very difficult to see it either going forward or backward.
Mm.
And the army, of course, is piggy in the middle, as people say. And really, unless there's political will, presumably, it will never change.
I don't think you can ever apply to Northern Ireland my first principle of winning the hearts and minds of the people. I think it's got beyond that. I mean, it's Protestants and Catholics, and although the majority of the population may loathe what's happening, but you'll never win the hearts and minds of the people.
Politicians.
I don't think the British Army is properly treated by the politicians. You know, they make these defence cuts. They give the soldiers and the officers increases in pay, and they then increase the rent of their houses and the rations, and in the end they are 2% worse off. They cut their overseas allowance. They don't get the same perks as the Foreign Office do when they go abroad, such as their cars being taken across wherever they may be going. And the soldiers are finding it financially extremely difficult. And that is why you're getting this exodus of far too many officers from the army, far too many pilots from the Royal Air Force. And the wives are not prepared to have these long separations. A lot of them are very highly qualified people before they're married, and they just won't put up with it. And I think what is wrong is that the higher echelons of the army are out of touch with the troops on the ground. There's far too length in the tail and far too teeth in the mouth. And I remember when I came back from Borneo and was debriefed by Healy and Mulley on unified command and on the army in general, I said that the army should be organized from front to rear, and not from rear, that is Whitehall, to the front. In other words, a section of men should never fall below 1 and 10. A platoon should never fall below 1 officer, 1 sergeant, and so many. A company should never fall below. A battalion should never fall below. The star turns from the Ministry of Defence should go out into the battlefield. And when you've done that, when your fighting troops have been fully brought up to strength with officers and men and equipment, you then see what is left over in the budget, and you'll find that you cannot afford to have all these static headquarters in England and this enormous, gigantic monster of a Ministry of Defence. I said that to Frank Mulley, and I say it again today.
In the light of what you've seen, you know, looking back over, perhaps you could just reflect a bit on looking back.
Well, looking back, a principle of war is the unexpected must be expected. And one never knows when a crisis is going to blow up, whether it is going to be in the Gulf, whether it is going to be in Grenada, when it's going to be in the Falklands. You know, in all these cases we were caught with our trousers down, whether it's going to be in Korea, in the Philippines, and all these places where the British Army has this, as I talked about before, this special technique and expertise. And therefore, our training should not be concentrated only on the central front in Europe. I think that it is not the central front of Europe. If it was in NATO, the northern flank would probably be more vulnerable than the central front, because the northern flank is so thinly defended. But it's these out-of-theater places where the army is more likely to be deployed and wanted. And therefore we should not only train for the nuclear battle, but we should train for these other types of warfare for which I have been talking. And I think it would give the soldier a much more variety of training if we were to concentrate on, or not concentrate on, only British Army of the Rhine, but on the type of fighting that we've had to do in the past. And I think history has a habit of repeating itself. And it would give the soldier much more interest in his training if he was able to I can't see, or certainly I hope that the British Army would ever be required for internal security on the mainland. It's certainly being required in Northern Ireland, but it's not internal security. That is,
how do you define Northern Ireland?
I define Northern Ireland as I did before, which is terrorism as a new form of warfare. And that is what we should be training for. Internal security in the city, in England, I would hope that the army would never be deployed in that role, as we were in my days in India. But you see, in India, the army is being brought in an increasing way for internal security in the city, and the same is happening in Pakistan, and will go on happening because of the question of Hindu versus Muslim. But I hope that in England, I would hope that the police would be able to deal with it, although I think that the police are grossly under strength for the tasks that they are being asked to do.
I think I'm glad.